What is up, and welcome back to 24 Minutes of A24, the podcast that takes a look at the A24 library 24 minutes at a time. I am Ethan Simi.
And I'm Ben Lawhorn. This week on the pod, we are partaking in consumerism and trying to figure out what the fuck is going on in Peter Strickland's 2018 horror comedy movie, In Fabric.
In Fabric is a haunting ghost story. Question mark. I feel like that we got a lot of question marks.
A lot of
we got
to work through on
this pod early on. Not a good start. Is a haunting ghost story set against the backdrop of a busy winter sales period in a department store, and follows the life of a cursed dress as it passes from person to person with devastating consequences. Just a note that this podcast was recorded and produced during the 2023 SAG-AFTRA strikes. Without the labor of the actors currently on strike, the movies being covered here on this podcast would not exist. Spoilers are ahead for In Fabric. If you don't want to be spoiled, go check out In Fabric. Okay. Of course, we have some housekeeping that we got to take care of. I feel like that's been the case as of late. I know we're getting towards the end of the year, so I feel like A24 is getting a little more revealing with some things that are coming out. And we got like an Iron Claw trailer. We got some cool stuff. We got a trailer for The Zone of Interest, which is really exciting. So I want your take on this trailer. 61 seconds long, very clear, concise. In my opinion, excellent trailer, but yeah. I want to know what you thought.
I mean, I am intrigued to say the least. Like, while I was watching it, I just kept thinking about the fact that you were lucky enough to have seen it already. I'm like, oh, he knows the context for all of these shots. Like, that's because there's something about that. When you go back and watch a trailer for a movie you've seen, you're like, oh, okay. And now I see
you get it. Yeah.
Like, or it's just like, oh shit, they picked that scene. Like, that's right at the end, you know, that kind of a
that's
thing.
That's literally one scene in this trailer specifically. I won't spoil. I won't say what it is. If you've seen the movie, you might have an idea. There is a moment in this trailer where I was just like, oh shit, they chose that.
Yeah.
And you'll know, we'll talk about it once we see this movie, but very much that vibe.
Yeah. So I'm excited. It's got me intrigued. I think it looks amazing. The buzz around it seems to be just super positive overall. So I can't wait. And I don't think it gave away too much, which is great. It's a great thing to get in a trailer.
Absolutely agree. I love the minute length. I think that is perfect for this. I think The Zone of Interest, obviously, I went in without seeing a trailer. I went in without seeing anything for this movie. I think it is probably the most haunting movie like I've ever seen. Of course, it's Jonathan Glazer, who is known for Under the Skin, another exceptionally haunting sci-fi, A24 movie. And this just kind of takes that haunting nature that he is so good at and puts that into a historical context. But I really like the trailer, and I'm genuinely excited to watch it again, even though it is not the kind of movie where you'd be like, hey, Friday movie night, you want to watch The Zone of Interest? Really not that kind of a movie. They also released a poster to go with it. What did you think of this poster?
I mean, again, it's like not giving away too much while bringing a lot of curiosity and intrigue to it. So it's one of those things where it's like, oh, that's a really unique design without literally a lot of stuff on it, which is kind of cool.
And it was released the same day as the first official, or I think maybe the second official poster for Saltburn, which is Emerald Fennell's next movie with Barry Keoghan and Jacob Elordi. I'm very excited for Saltburn. Did you see the poster for that just quickly? I know it's not A24. But
is that the kaleidoscope looking one?
It is. Yeah, it is. I don't know. I think some people are pretty high on it, but that poster was not for me. I think I'm much more of a kind of a simple poster guy. And so to get those two on the same day, juxtaposed against one another, it really confirmed to me like, wow, I like clean, simple posters.
That was your Barbenheimer.
Yeah, that was day. 100%. Yeah. That's to this day was my Barbenheimer for movie posters.
Saltburn of Interest, yeah.
yeah, we got to get that trending. Saltburn of Interest.
Let's go. Let's make it happen.
I genuinely, and I've mentioned this maybe before on this podcast, if not on my Twitter, like, it would be sick as fuck to have a best poster category at the Academy Awards. Like, of course, I think best stunt should come first. I think a lot of other things should come first. But I think there would be some really cool incentive, and this poster for The Zone of Interest would 1,000,000% be in that category. Having seen the movie, it's incredibly representative of the aura and the vibe and the nature of the entire film from the start to the finish. And it is essentially just a picture of the house, the place of residence that our main character and their family stay at, with the sky and everything surrounding it in black. And yeah, that is just frightening stuff. So yeah, Zone of Interest is going well. And I think it's interesting that we talk about this week, because last week we talked about all of this new A24 kind of strategy and like how they're going ahead with certain things. And one of the topics we brought up was their ambiguity in their release schedule. Lo and behold, we get a trailer for The Zone of Interest. And what does it say? Coming soon. It doesn't tell us a date. It doesn't give us a nationwide. It doesn't give us a limited release. It just says coming soon.
Yeah.
After our conversation last week, has your like viewpoint on that specifically changed at all? Like, seeing coming soon, are you still excited for The Zone of Interest? Are you just like, what the hell? Like, tell me the day I'm going to see this movie.
I think I'm always going to want that, you know, like, just let me know when I can finally see this. That still seems to be an issue. Was it Iron Claw or something? The poster said like in limited theaters on this day. I'm like, okay, good. It's good to know then that like that's going to be the limited theater day. Hopefully that means a week later it'll go nationwide. Yeah, just like, I don't know, maybe there's stuff going on behind the scenes that keep them from releasing these dates, but just like, let us know. Like, I just want to know when I can see this. That's all.
You are getting to see Dicks the Musical next week. I think it's coming to your city finally.
Finally. Yeah, it's finally showing up.
Gosh, I can't believe Salt Lake City is like, let's put Dicks the Musical against Killers of the Flower Moon and Taylor Swift the Eras Tour. Like, let's just toss it in the mix.
It's a horrible call. I don't know
that's
what to
tell you. That's a cage match right there.
Yeah,
it's gonna movies.
Be, yeah, exactly.
That's tough. Okay, cool. Zone of Interest trailer. One more piece of housekeeping before we talk about In Fabric, a movie that I have so many questions for you about. So many questions. Martin Scorsese, I just mentioned, has a new movie coming out, Killers of the Flower Moon. A little preview. Have we mentioned it? We've posted it on Twitter and Instagram. Is this correct?
I think so.
Okay. So we posted it on socials. Go follow us if you haven't. But in case we haven't, for whatever reason, like clearly mentioned it here on the show, we are doing a Martin Scorsese collaborative draft, power rankings, what have you, at the end of the month. So next week's episode, we're going to have a guest from across the pond, which is really exciting. Someone quite popular and Twitter famous in the kind of the film Twitter sphere or TikTok sphere to join us to try to tackle that. But included in that is Killers of the Flower Moon. Of course, Martin Scorsese has kind of been the core of the cinema conversations probably the last 2 weeks now.
Yeah.
With this movie coming out, having a red carpet premiere. Him and Timothée Chalamet are part of like a GQ talk. Really exciting stuff, to be honest. It's really a special, unique thing to be like, we're getting a Scorsese movie in theaters, and now he like gets to talk about all these really cool things about movies. He did come out and say that the pacing of Killers of the Flower Moon is inspired by Ari Aster's films, and this is what he said. Quote, I very much like the style and pacing of good horror films, like Ari Aster's Midsommar and Beau is Afraid. Two questions, Ben. One, what do you think of Martin Scorsese's reverence for Ari Aster? This is not the first time we've heard of it. He's mentioned it far before. And Ari Aster even has like a Criterion short, essentially, to, like talking about Scorsese. They've been in conversation together. I believe Scorsese was at the Lincoln Center premiere of Beau is Afraid for a Q&A back when that came out as well. Second question, Scorsese, it seems like Scorsese implies that Beau is Afraid is a horror film.
Yeah.
Do you agree or disagree?
I don't know that there's a person on this planet that should question what Marty Scorsese says about
I'm setting
a movie.
You up for a trap.
Yeah, like there's no way. Like, I don't know anyone that could be like, you know what? He's wrong. Like
he's wrong.
Yeah. There's definitely like horror thriller elements to it. I think it's kind of a loose definition, but again, like I'm not gonna tell Marty he's wrong. That's fine. Watched so many of his movies in the last few weeks, and
Oh, man.
The dude's a genius. Like, it's amazing. It's going to be
every
really
new Scorsese movie I watch or every rewatch that I go through, I'm just like, he's a genius. Yeah. How did he do it? I don't know.
I'll tell you what, a little moment of vulnerability here. For half a second, I was like, is Goodfellas that good? You know, like, I don't know.
Oh, my God.
Well, it's just been so long since I'd seen it.
What's wrong with
you? It's been so long since I had seen it, and it is so hyped up. You know, it's like 5 stars for everybody. I'm like, is that really the case? And then I watched it. I was like, it is. It's fucking amazing. Like, it's just one of the best movies that's ever been made. You know what I mean?
You're like, I'm not going to question Scorsese, but also, is Goodfellas even that good?
No, hold on. Hold the fuck on. I'm questioning everyone else who's saying that, like, it's the best movie ever made. I was like, I don't know. It's just, like, the hype around it, but it is. It's fantastic. It's such a good movie.
Thank God.
Yeah, it was. It's, I don't know. It's so good.
I'm glad you didn't zag on the Goodfellas consensus. Oh,
can you imagine? Imagine if I came in here with the hot take of like number 11, Goodfellas.
My God.
Oh, that'd be nuts.
I'm like sick to my stomach right now just thinking about that. Oh, God.
Well, I just like the idea, though, of Scorsese watching these Ari Aster films, you know, that he like enjoyed Midsommar and Beau's Afraid. Like, I think that's fantastic. Yeah, I don't know. I'm curious to see. He talks about pacing of good horror films, and that's like what's, you know, helped this. And I read the book. I did that over that vacation. Oh, right. So I can see what the horror elements are, I think, that he might be referring to. So I'm very, very curious to see how that transpires on the big screen.
Killers of the Flower Moon is 3 hours and 26 minutes long. I believe that is 6 minutes longer or 3 minutes longer than The Irishman, which is pretty wild stuff. So, yeah, to hear him talk about like the pacing of good horror films is really interesting in the context of Killers of the Flower Moon, which is like based on a book, based on real life events, a movie that is highly centered on like massive dramatic set pieces. I can assume. Yeah. I haven't seen the movie yet. I'll see it tomorrow night, but by the time this podcast comes out, I will have seen the film. So you're getting my post Killers vibes right now. I'll be a changed person afterwards, probably. So yeah, I think it's really cool that Scorsese has like latched on to Ari Aster as his guy, as like his new wave kind of dude. To basically say like he makes really cool shit and I respect it and it's way different than the stuff that I make. And I think that is really insightful, and I love like kind of the inverse of that everything that I've read or seen Ari Aster is just like, why do you like my stuff? Like, you're Martin Scorsese. Why are you attached to my horror films? Which I think is really cool too. Like, and to just be like, okay, I guess like he finds something that he likes about it, and I'm just gonna like keep making my things. I wonder how much influence they kind of have in each other's future projects. Like whatever Ari is working on next, I'm really curious if he feels like he could consult Marty and basically be like, what do you think about this? Or like, do you want to executive produce this with me? Or like whatever the case might be. I think their relationship is a really fascinating one.
Yeah, it gives me similar vibes of in the music world, like when Bowie was telling people like, oh, you know who I love? Arcade Fire. Like before they really like still first album before that came out. It's like, okay, you got to listen because it's David Bowie who's talking here. Mm-hmm. And like the dude has an ear. He knows music and he really likes this band. And it's like, oh, okay. And it's just so interesting to hear some of these, you know, the godfathers of cinema or music express their opinions of who they like. And it's like, oh, there's got to be something there. You give this like level of at least respect, if not reverence, to whatever it is that they really enjoy. So it's kind of giving me that similar vibe. It's like, you should check them out. And I think that's great that they're doing that. At some point you got to pass it along, and I think that's cool.
It does make me wonder, what are the conversations behind closed doors of like Ari saying, I know last week you were like, let's throw the bag at Marty. Like, I wonder if there's any reality to that at some point in time. I don't think so. Like, let's be very clear. I don't think Martin Scorsese is going to make an A24 film. He turns 81 this year. I just don't think it's in the cards. And I don't think A24 thinks it's in the cards. But like, I wonder what Ari tells him about like yeah, I've made all three of my movies through A24. Like, they're a great production company. Like, they're really cool. They gave me $30 million to make a box office flop. Like, really exciting stuff. And I wonder what Scorsese thinks about that as, like, an A24 brand, right? Like, as coming up through the, you know, the 70s and 80s and 90s and, like, ultimately distributing all of his movies through Universal, through Warner Brothers, through different companies, through now through Apple TV, through Netflix for The Irishman. Like, he's been around the block, and he's just like, whoever's going to let me get this made sounds good to me. And, like, yeah. So I really wonder what his thoughts on, like, the A24 style of business are. I think that would be a really cool, like, let me just be a ghost or shadow and, like, follow them wherever they go situation. But yeah, pretty cool stuff. So really exciting. Zone of Interest trailer, I'm really excited for. I think it's a December 15th. So I think we're coming up, nice. Which is going to be really, really cool. Definitely covering it here on the show. Okay. Are you ready to talk about In Fabric?
Ready as I'm going to be.
Okay. We're back to spooky season. This is another kind of A24 horror film that we decided this year, this October. Of course, we had Dicks the Musical, which was a new release. And then we're kind of capping off the month, as we have been doing the last couple of months, with a collaborative draft. So the two episodes in between those, we decided to do some more deep cut horror films. So we did The Black Coat's Daughter last horror movie, so two episodes ago. And now we're doing In Fabric. Shit, I don't know where to start, Ben. I just don't know where to start.
Was this recommended by somebody? Because I know Black Coat's Daughter was, or is this one that we just kind of pulled out? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Kind of curious.
If you suggested it, please let us know and, like,
yeah,
tell us how much we suck, because we're forgetting again if someone suggested it.
We gotta make better notes of that.
God, we're terrible.
Where do we start with this movie, man? Like, this movie ended and I was just like, all right, okay. You know,
okay.
Like,
really? Okay.
Yeah. Like, I didn't have a bad time with it.
Interesting.
You know, I laughed at some stuff. I thought it was like the two guys who run, I forget what that place is, but yeah. Have you seen Office Space? They kind of remind me of the Bobs, like the guys
that were
the consultants, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, oh, 2 minutes for a pee is like a, you know, that's substantial.
I timed myself.
It was two and a half minutes, you know? It's just like, there's some funny stuff in there.
Their names were Clive and Stash.
Clive and Stash, yeah. You know, it's like, oh yeah, we found someone, or there's this business that's like looking for a position. They're like, oh no, they're actually just looking for that person. Like, they've lost that person.
Dude,
you know?
That
it's
was
like,
hysterical.
Okay. Yeah, there's some really, really good stuff in here. But it like, I guess maybe I wanted more comedy, you know, like make it a little bit more, because it felt like there was some there, but it was just riding this like real thin line between like just a straight horror. And then all of a sudden there's just like some funny stuff in here. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't Shaun of the Dead funny. And mm-hmm. I don't know that it needed to be like that funny, but I don't know. For some reason, I just like, I wanted a little more or a little less, because it was just like, it was just a weird amount of comedy for me. Although I did enjoy, I had an okay time with the movie. I thought the cast did a good job. I thought, you know, like the way that the people at the store speak, you know, in that, like, I don't even know, it's not even Shakespearean, but it's just like this weird prose.
It's kind of like a sci-fi prose a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, oh man, this is like, it's so interesting. Like, I get what you're saying. I just never would have thought to say it that way. Like, all right, that's cool. And that, like, we don't necessarily get an explanation about why the dress is like haunted or anything. It's just like taking out anybody that has worn it. Right. Like, not just touched it, like had to have worn it. Because everyone that we see in the movie that wears it suffers from it. I don't know.
Yeah. Let's go over that real quick. I think that's a really good, like, jumping off point. I think I had a really good time with this movie. I will just say I like this far more than I thought that I would like this. Do I think it rivals the A24 horror greats? No. But do I think it's a hidden gem in the A24 catalog? Absolutely, I do. So it's about this dress, this red dress that people wear, and it essentially then causes destruction or deadly consequences in their lives. First, we follow Sheila, who works at a bank, has these interactions with her kind of superiors, goes and buys this dress from a very nice department store that has incredible sales, excellent bargains, and then proceeds to wear the dress, and we get about an hour of Sheila's life and her relationship with her son and her son's girlfriend and like these kind of intricate daily things and her first dates. Mm-hmm. All of this to then establish a point where the dress like leaves a skin emblem, essentially. It's like, yeah, like kind of like a mark of a beast, branded, right? Of like, yeah, like you're like branded. And that's how you know like death is coming for you from this dress. She then is on a drive, sees a mannequin on the side of the road, proceeds to crash the car, and the red dress essentially kills her, like floats over her and kills her. We then get a really hard cut to a new character named Reg Speaks. Similar situation. We get less time with him, but we understand that he's engaged and we kind of like figure out his life. He puts on the red dress through his bachelor party, mm-hmm, is really what it is. Death comes for him as well. His fiance tries on the red dress. Death comes for her. And then we kind of figure out like this department store is some kind of like interesting, weird, satanic cult, corporate elitist, consumerism cult. I don't know, question mark. And I think that's kind of where I want to lead the conversation with the mythology of not only the red dress, but like what surrounds the red dress. I think there are things about it that work well. And I think part of the intrigue and the mystery and what does work about this is exactly that, is the mystery, is the intrigue of like, what were they doing with that mannequin? And like, basically like feeling up the mannequin and then all of a sudden it's starting to grow hair and like turning into a person. Like, what is that? What is this like old guy doing? And like, why is there a mannequin on the side of the road? Like, I think there's a lot of questions why, you know, a major spoiler alert, but like why at the end of the movie are there different levels of everybody that's died? Why are they all sewing these red dresses? What does that mean? You mentioned it. Why do they talk the way that they talk in the department store? Things like that. I think part of the mystery is what makes it work, but also its downfall, because I would have loved a little bit more mythology. I would have loved a little bit more just direct context of like what we're dealing with here. I don't know if you felt the same way, but I thought it was very interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, it was a super interesting conclusion, as you know, she's in that dumb waiter with the other, like the mannequin head, and we see her torso and head, and we see how similar they are. It's like, oh, so was she like a mannequin that came to life at one point? Like, is
okay,
that
that's what I thought too. Okay, good.
Right. Yeah, and then going down the dumbwaiter, just seeing all these people that are sewing the red dresses, like, oh, is this just like a continual thing? Like, you're just kind of trapped to make those for the rest of your life? I don't know.
It kind of felt like Us, like Jordan Peele's Us a little bit, where there's like kind of like this like mirrored dimension that is like really kind of a more demonic dimension. I really like that aspect of the movie, but like I don't get it. Like, I don't get what the dress, how is the dress haunted? If they just sew it, the mythology that we're kind of given in the movie is like the model in the catalog that wore this dress died.
Mm-hmm.
And then something about that, like her soul stuck with that, or like she feels the need for vengeance to kill those who then wear her red dress. How? I'm completely overanalyzing this movie, but how does the dress work? How does it float? How does it attack? Because it attacks the son's like girlfriend. Mm-hmm. How does it do that? Like, how does it make the washers go crazy?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Do they haunt it? Do they put some sort of spell on it? Because then whoever this thing kills begins to make clothes for them. You know what I mean? Like, I know, like, is the store putting like the spell on this dress? I'm not sure. Like you said, like, I don't know what, I couldn't tell if they were mannequins that came to life.
I feel like they were.
Right. Like, it kind of just like by the fact they took off their wig and then they were bald and stuff like that. That kind of is what made me think that. But the dude himself, like, is he some sort of like evil?
The old guy, right?
Yeah, the old guy.
That masturbates in front of them turning a mannequin into a human.
Which also, I read something about that, that the original cut of the movie, they show him coming on a dress, and then that dress goes on sale the next day, but like the stain has become like some sort of design element of the dress.
Oh my God.
And someone buys it and takes it. But I guess like the, whatever the British version of the MPAA, which is like, nope, you can't do that. Sorry, not for this rating.
Infinity pool style, you got to cut it.
Yeah, you got to take it out. It's like, oh, that, they were really going for it in this movie. That's kind of nuts. But yeah, it's like he's some evil like wizard or demon or like what is what's the, I don't know. You know what I mean? I have no idea what he is. So it's like, yeah, it's okay that they kind of leave it up to us. But I'm with you. Like, I wouldn't have minded a little more context of just like, okay, tell us. Like, all right. Just let us know like what's going on here. Cause like the commercials are put you in a trance.
Yep.
It seems like, and to get you in the store. And everyone just loses their goddamn mind at the end of this movie. And it was pretty fun to watch that.
It is. It's pretty wild. So on this train of thought, let me ask you some more questions. And then we can do some more general talk. We can do our true cinemas and go through this. So when we cut to Reg speaks, which I thought was an incredibly effective like storyline transition in my opinion. I think it worked really well to like mythologize even more. Like, this is not just a Sheila thing. This is not just her and her family. Like, this is a multifaceted plan of attack from this department store to go after these people. What is the deal? What's the deal with, if you like Jerry Seinfeld, what's the deal with those airplane peanuts, huh? What's the deal with the way that Reg speaks, talks about fixing washers? This is my really big question. Like, the mythology of the dress is like fine. And like, I can grasp like the really heavy themes of like, you know, deep, dark consumerism and like, kind of sexual ecstasy, and how all of that combines to like make a very like consumer-centric lifestyle.
Yeah.
But when he talks about fixing dishwashers, when he talks about fixing like laundry washers, the very noticeable scene is with those two guys, Clive and Stash.
Yeah,
they like coerce him into talking. They set up a role play, which I thought was really funny and also extremely awkward. And as soon as he starts talking, they enter almost like a psychosexual trance. They like hold hands. What's your take? What's your thoughts? I gotta know, because I don't know what the fuck was happening.
I just think it puts people in a sort of trance. Like I did, like I said, I read a little interview with him, and I think he talked about in there of like
with Peter Strickland, is this
the Peter director? Okay. Yeah, with the director and writer. And he mentioned like people being able to just like talk about whatever that it is they do for their work in such like a monotone kind of like whatever way that you can't even get a word in, that it kind of puts you into a trance as you're like listening to the
genius.
Like,
that's incredible.
You're almost like zoned out. You're like, I don't know what this person's talking about anymore. Like, okay. Yeah. And so it's just like an elevated version of that. When the two guys do it, it almost becomes, like you said, kind of this like semi-sexual thing that like, we'll give you a better interest rate if you'll do it for us, you know. It's like, okay, cool. Like, I don't know.
I like that a lot. I obviously that makes a lot of sense. Now that I think about it, I think it really does play into the themes of the movie very, very well, of like this monotonous lifestyle that is wholly driven by dark consumerism. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a really smart and interesting choice to like really base your story around this department store that like has bargains. And like, what does Sheila talk about on her first dates with everybody? The bargains that she's getting, and they bring love coupons, and like this exceptionally consumerized version of life, I think is really, really cool. Also haunting and frightening, like the way that it's portrayed. But yes, I would have loved some more context, a little bit more direct knowledge of like what we're dealing with here and what we're managing. But I liked it and I think it worked. And the movie is very, I mean, it's very sexy, to be honest. Like, it's very, it's pretty hot. It's, I think that works well for this movie. And it kind of has this like French horror, like 1960s, like, let's just like cut shit up and get weird vibe to it in between certain scenes where we get like kind of these montages with this exceptionally eerie and elevated score. And then we get like a hand with like red nails that like comes over the top. And it's a little bit disorienting, but it also makes sense. Like, they have their hand over the people, over the consumers. They are managing what is happening in this town or in the city. So yeah, I think there are a lot of things that worked. I had quite a good time with this movie. Do you want to do True Cinema? Do you have anything else to talk about before we go?
Let's get into True Cinema.
Okay, let's do it. I mentioned Sheila. She's kind of our first character victim, if you will, whatever you want to mention. Gwendoline Christie, who plays Gwen in this movie, is obviously from Game of Thrones. She's from Star Wars, from other things as well. I believe she's worked with Peter Strickland on another project as well, which I thought was really fascinating. Oh, okay. So she's the girlfriend of Sheila's son, whose name is Vince. And Sheila walks in on Gwen modeling. And basically, that's our first introduction to all three of these characters. And I think it's really pretty funny and really, really weird for Sheila. Sheila's already kind of a weird person. And a little bit awkward. And so like for her to walk in on like on Vince like sketching his girlfriend and basically like not holding a conversation with her, I thought was a really weird scene, but also really effective for their relationship like dynamics that we end up getting into.
Yeah, like, I mean, when he just responds with, like, she's modeling, you know, like, that's why she's not responding to you, whatever. Yeah. It's like,
she just started.
Yeah, because at first, we obviously don't know that she knows Gwen. So it just looks like there's a stranger in her house. Yes. Modeling. It's like, oh, okay. But then she addresses her by name and you realize, okay, she does know her. This is almost a little weirder now, you know, that this is just like a thing that happens in this household. But yeah, it was a good way to show the dynamic between her and her son, I think, and just kind of the relationship they have.
What is your take on the Sheila like conversations that she has with those two guys, Stash and Clive? She is seen a lot like talking to her coworkers, kind of like in the hallway, and like being repeatedly called back to her kind of till like space, like at the bank. And then she has these conversations with Clive and Stash about like, she's not an efficient, like, you know, employee, or right, she's taking like mysterious bathroom breaks. Obviously I think like overtone wise goes hand in hand with like this consumerism and exceptionally like robotic consumerism of our lives and like how our lives are just defined by our monotonous jobs. But what did you think of how all that played out and essentially continued to only give us little nuggets here and there?
I mean, I thought it was cool just giving us like a little taste of what she's like at work. Again, those interviews with Clive and Stash, that's what it was, right? Is that,
yeah, I think so.
I mean, those are just some of the best parts of the movie to me. I really enjoy their interactions. You know, talking about going to the bathroom on the clock and stuff like that. You know, it's like she's getting ratted out by some annoying person at her work. So I thought all that stuff played out really well.
Yeah. Okay. Next scene is when she is caught peeping on Gwen and Vince, and Vince is basically having oral sex with Gwen. She and Sheila looks through the people and makes eye contact with Gwen. For me, that really solidified like Sheila is kind of pretty weird and like is pretty desperate for her husband has passed away, I believe, and is pretty desperate for like any sense of sexual release or ecstasy or enjoyment or whatever it may be. And she instead turns to retail to try to like fill that void. Yeah. But a really weird scene, and you even text me, you're like, how not safe for work are we going to get? Because I'm trying to watch this at work, and I saw that scene, and like, are we going to get weird? And it's kind of the weirdest, but like, it's still pretty weird.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. It's an interesting dynamic because, so I think she's divorced because the son talks about dad's new girlfriend
going over to
like
dad's,
making the curry. I think that's what inspires her to like get back on the dating, whatever. I think this takes place in 93 or whatever, right? I think something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, there wasn't Tinder or Bumble or anything like that. It was all
she
just
has to
like
do
the
mail.
Newspapers. Yeah. It was just kind of funny. But yeah, what a awkward interaction to have. Mm-hmm. That'd be
really,
so weird.
Really weird. Okay, Adonis, the first date with Adonis. The guy is just nothing like he describes himself as.
No, he is not an Adonis by any means.
Not even close. The only Adonis that I'm familiar with is Adonis Creed from Creed, and that's what I think all Adonis just should look like. And
without a doubt. Yeah, 100%. This guy is not running down the streets of Philadelphia at all. he was, I mean, it was a funny interaction, you know, she's like trying to get to know him. He's like, what is this, a quiz or something? Like, no, it's just like a fucking basic interaction, dude. Like you said, you like laughter and you're the most monotone, straight laced person that we've ever met here. So, I like their interaction.
She's like, oh, so you dance? And he's like, not tonight. I'm injured. She's I wasn't talking about it. I was just talking about it in general. Really awkward first date for sure. Next one up, the board game and the washing machine. This is when the dress is washed in the washing machine and shit gets out of control. The washing machine goes haywire, which was, again, a really smart connection to bring from Sheila to our next guy, Reg, and have them kind of connected through that that experience. The washing machine goes crazy. She ends up getting hurt, and all this is kind of like intercut with the three of them, Gwen, Vince, and Sheila, playing a board game. And Gwen and Vince are talking in French, and I guess Vince is practicing for his for schooling, and basically talking shit about Sheila right in front of her. And because Sheila and Gwen have a very bad, very toxic relationship to one another. They don't like each other whatsoever. And then the washing machine gets out of control, and it's really kind of this tea kettle moment where we're just like progressively, we know something is going to go off the rails in one of these two places. We just don't know which one yet. And then we everything explodes. The steam goes off, and it's weird because like we still don't know, why does the dress not like to be washed? I don't know.
Still don't know. Yeah, it's fun seeing them play sorry because you know, Sheila makes the call to play nice and not like destroy Gwen's peace during the game. But then Gwen's like, nope, fuck you. I'm not doing it anyway. So a real insight into their dynamic.
Yeah. Next one on the list, the mannequin ritual. I briefly mentioned this. So this is kind of the first time that we really see what's going on behind the scenes at the department store. Our main, like the main kind of employee woman that we're like the saleswoman that we are attached with most of the time, is with somebody else, and they are caressing this mannequin up and down very sensually, and the old guy is watching and he starts to masturbate, and then this mannequin grows pubic hair and essentially starts to turn into a human. And that's when I thought we were going to progress into this very like, oh wow, okay, they can turn mannequins into humans, and now I can understand like where we're coming at from, like mannequins want to be more like real life, or they have a vendetta against people who can wear things like they cannot and things like that. But then we don't ever explore that ever again.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. We see how much they care about these mannequins during the outbreak at the end, you know, because they're like more protective of the mannequins than they are of the people that are there. So yeah, it is. It's so interesting if like some get lucky enough to become human, you know, but they have these relationships with all of them. I don't know. It was such an interesting ritual. Obviously, we talked about stuff that got cut from this scene. There's menstrual blood as it's getting fingered, you know, like there's just like all kinds of stuff going on. It's kind of crazy. It's probably the most like crazy thing that happens in this movie, I'd say, without a doubt, pretty easily. But yeah, it was a lot.
Very, very, very weird. The dress attacks Gwen. I briefly mentioned this. Gwen is, again, like a scene that revolves around masturbation or sexual ecstasy, which is really interesting. Gwen is masturbating and the dress attacks her, or we think we are led to believe that the dress attacks her, because then Vince kind of like wakes her up and is like, what happened? What happened? And she seems to be fine. But I just wanted to put this on there because I think it's a good connective tissue to like the ideas between like this retail therapy, this sexual therapy, and this like this ghost dress that's very vengeful.
Yeah, I was curious about how it makes the decision of who it attacks, because we know
Gwen doesn't wear it.
That's, yeah, exactly. Like, right, Gwen doesn't exactly. wear it. So whoever wears it dies, you know, or, you know, and but the people that just like hold it, or I don't know. I'm kind of curious what the reasoning was. Maybe I missed something, but
do we see Gwen after this scene at all? Because I don't think we do.
I'm not sure that we do either. I don't remember
I don't
seeing
so.
Her.
Yeah. No, me neither. It very interesting. Again, I feel like maybe just some slightly more concrete context could have been a little bit more beneficial. But, you know, I think part of the fun, part of the conversation is like, what happened? I guess we don't know. Then we get the dog that attacks Sheila. Sheila's wearing the red dress. The dog comes and attacks her, which we can only infer means like the dog is attacking the dress for some reason.
Yeah.
And then the dress essentially comes back and Vince brings it back to her room and is like, yeah, it's totally fine. Like, no rips, no nothing. And Sheila's like, are you crazy? Like, this should have been totally ripped up.
Yeah.
And it's not. Again, I guess we just need to believe, like, it's just possessed and, like, that's okay.
Yeah, we just have to accept that. And somehow animals have intuition about evil dresses.
Right.
So, yeah.
No, that makes sense. I mean, that's good. That's good to know. So if I ever see a dog, like, going after a garment, I'm like, that's cursed. It's
yeah, if you get an evil beanie, you know, watch out for dogs, you know, just in case.
Yeah. I guess that's a good like pro tip, like get a pet dog. That way it'll sniff out any yep, demonic no problems. fabrics that you have in your home. Okay. The car accident I mentioned, Sheila has a car accident. How did the mannequin get by the side of the road and by the cornfield, Ben?
I don't know. That's the thing. Like, was it a real person that all of a sudden at some point, like Cinderella, you know, strikes midnight and all of a sudden becomes a mannequin again? Like I have no idea. Yeah, I really have no clue. No clue.
That's I want more from this movie. I want either another movie or I want more. I'm like 10 minutes more. I want to explore that. I think that's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. But on the contrary, like it does inherently pull us away from the core idea of like consumerism is deadly.
Yeah,
right. And like that idea that is chasing. I think that's a really good tangential like thought process and idea from the director that might just not have like been able to elaborate on because it just didn't quite fit the text. But I don't know. And I want to know. I'm very curious. Maybe if Peter Strickland has DMs open, maybe I'll shoot him a DM and
yeah, come on, please.
Tell us how the mannequin got there. Okay. Then I said we cut to Reg. The night out with Reg's boys, namely his fiance Babs, her dad, that is just like getting our boy Reg completely plastered. What's up with this?
Just dad's getting their son-in-law's plastered, I guess. This is their, sounds like it was his like little stag do thing, you know, just like the last party before getting married. Was your father-in-law at yours?
No. So my father-in-law passed away before Molly and I got married, unfortunately. But I feel like I can confidently speak to the fact that he would not have been at a stag party because I don't know how he would have fit into that vibe.
That's
but
what
maybe,
I was wondering.
I don't know. You never know.
Yeah, that's what as I was watching this, I got thinking about that. Obviously, you know, I'm sorry I didn't know that about. Yeah. But it's just like, do a lot of father-in-laws go to these things? Like that seems
that
so
was what I was wondering
weird,
too.
You know, that it's like, is this guy like, I don't know. He can hang with these other 30-year-olds that are just like trying to get plastered and stuff. Like he's just trying to relive his youth. Who knows?
Our boy Reg speaks just doing the most to not let the squad down.
Yeah.
That's all he cared about. He's like, I just didn't want to let him down. I didn't want to let the crew down.
Ruining his shirt, you know, all for the crew.
So funny. So he gets the scar because he does wear the red dress, which then kind of cements this mythology a little bit of like, okay, this is how the dress operates. We can kind of understand. We get it a little bit better at this point in time. The next one I have on the list is when Reg is having sex with Babs. Again, a core text of this is like sexual release and sexual ecstasy. In this situation, not done as like erotically or even efficiently as like how Gwen does it, or even the old guy does it. Reg is just like trying to have sex with her, like from behind, and she's like, if you invite this person, then you got to invite these people, and then you got to stick up for these group of people. And it's just like, we're going over wedding plans right now. And Reg is just like, you got
to
stop.
He's trying
and
to focus.
I felt so bad for him.
He's really trying to focus, you know, and she's trying to figure out the table seating, you know. It's just like, well, you can't invite these people because these people are going to come. It's like, I'll tell you who's not going to come, and it's Reg, you know. Like, he's talking about this, that's for sure.
Just the complete opposite of the Howard Ratner moment right there.
Yeah.
Just like, holy shit, I'm blocked up. I thought that was pretty funny. Okay, so we then get two dreams. We get a dream with Sheila, which is worth mentioning. She talks about her mother and how she has a bad dream. And I think this is part of the mythology of the dress. It kind of curses you with nightmarish qualities and bad dreams. Sheila's dream was that she turned into her dead mother or mother-in-law, or whatever it was, and had a scar all over her face. And she got onto the bus, in her dream, and just like, again, shout out these two guys. Cause one of them, I don't know who it was, but he was like, racists. And then she's like, I smelt like a corpse.
About race. It's like, I smell like a dead person. That's why they're under their seats.
So funny. And I found it incredibly intriguing that she goes into the utmost detail about this dream. And then they were like, what color was the bus? And then they write down the color of the bus, which again, like, question marks. What does this mean? But we get the dream that Reg explains to them of how Babs went into labor. He was late, so he was locked out of the room. He essentially tried to help take on Babs' pain by yelling and screaming. He was really more of a nuisance. The nurses for Babs were the saleswomen from the shop. And Babs has a kid, and the kid comes out. This is the weirdest fucking thing.
So cool, though.
So cool, but the kid comes out wearing the red dress and flips Reg off, and that's like the dream. And at that moment, I was like, oh, wow, cool. Like, Peter Strickland's kind of really fucked up guy. This is fun.
And I couldn't tell if the baby's eyelids were closed or just had white eyes. Like, it was kind of nuts. But I love just that little turn of its hand with the middle finger out, just flipping him off. I thought that was hilarious.
So disturbing. And really, for me, like, what sends this into what kind of like maybe kicked it up a notch or two in terms of the horror of like, okay, that's like, I don't want to be thinking about that when I'm trying to fall asleep kind of a situation. We then get Babs's catalog dream when she believes that she is in the catalog in the store. She's getting skinnier and skinnier, but her dress size continues to get bigger and bigger. Really smart, like, play on the consumerism and on like the kind of outward appearance of someone's body and self-confidence and how that plays into all of these other forms that we've been talking about and thinking about the whole movie. Pretty scary visuals too, of like her in the catalog turning into a skeleton. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. And getting all cut up and stuff. And I honestly, I just got thinking about the production that had to go into this. I'm like, oh, like, she probably actually had to model for all this stuff. Like, how long did that take to do all that? Because like, that's all, it all looked legit. So that was a great scene.
Wow, putting in the work. You mentioned the outbreak. This is kind of like the final scene of the film. There's a fire. Babs is trying on the red dress, essentially gets stuck in her fitting room. The red dress starts a fire in the store, in the department store. The main saleswoman is then just scavenging to save mannequins while everybody else is fighting and trying to take product while their lives are at risk. Very, you know, very basic, but very smart in my opinion, like way to kind of end and cap off this theme. And then as she goes down the dumbwaiter, we see Sheila, Reg, and Babs all sewing these red dresses down below the store. What is your thought on like this whole thing, this whole final scene? And like, what do you think it all means in terms of like them sewing the red dress?
Dude, I have no idea. Like, it's crazy. I don't even want to like try to make something up. Like, I just really, I just feel like they get trapped again. Like, I think there's some sort of possessed quality to this dress. And so whoever it takes, like takes it, dies. And then it's tied to this place, which is like a store, but also just kind of like a haunted
an underworld.
Place. Yeah, like an underworld, exactly. And it's just like they just get trapped there then forever. So I don't know. I really enjoyed it all, watching everyone just like lose their shit, you know, and fighting and just like complete chaos. Just the message of like consumerism and all that, just how it drives all of us. I thought it was really well done. It was a cool way to end it, but yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know what it's about. It's crazy.
I guess the more that I think about it, the more that I talk about it, eternal, I guess I kind of view it as like this eternal damnation for what people end up filling like the concentration of their souls with. Like, these people were so upset. Like, Sheila was so like pretty obsessed about how she looked in this dress. And Babs was like, how do I fit in this dress? I look so good. Like, how is it my size? And like this very kind of like superficial version of ourselves and how we're attached to that consumerism and that essentially, eternal damnation for like you're sewing the dress that you died in. Like this is what caused your death, is that you cared about this single article of clothing that like could have cared about other things. You could have like had a better relationship with your son, or like had a, you know, you could have like left your fiance for someone you actually loved or cared about, or like whatever. So I do think there's a lot of interesting things. Again, like I think it falls a little bit short just because of the context and because of the lack of like clear information that we get, but I liked it. I thought it was really fun. And I would say, I know we're not at the rating part quite yet, but I would say this is like, to me, this is, if you've seen Hereditary, if you've seen Midsommar, if you've seen like Pearl, X, Talk to Me, if you've seen The Big Guns.
Yeah.
This to me would be like that top of the next tier where it's like, cool, you want to get into some deeper like A24 horror? Like, I think this might be the way to go. I think this would be like a really kind of good start because it does have a lot of elements to it that are really interesting and enticing horror that also fit with under that A24 umbrella that you might be expecting. So I think that's pretty cool. Okay, I have two A1 acts for you, for us. I have a question first, though. For A24 horror movies, I just mentioned like kind of the upper echelon. I'm going to assume In Fabric does not change any of your like top five or any of like your power rankings.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's like it affects my top 10 overall, maybe my top 10 horror, you know, A24 horror. It might work its way up into there, you know, at the bottom. Like I said, I had a good time with it. I can't explain it, but you don't have to do that, I guess, with everything, right? Like, just enjoy something for what it is. So,
Yeah. No, that's fair. I obviously, I still think Midsommar is the best. And I think First Reformed is like, for me, is up there in like a top 10 A24 of like all time. Yeah. Is not like a pure horror, but definitely like in that vein. Mm-hmm. But for me, I think this is definitely up there. It is not better than Hereditary. I don't think it's better than like Talk to Me or Pearl, but I think it's pretty close to like to edging some of those out. Let's do the A1 act. So I've got Gwendoline Christie, who we kind of mentioned plays Gwen. She's in a lot of stuff. And so I just thought a lot of popular stuff. So I thought let's kind of like dive into that and see where we're at. So The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2. I wanted to ask you, are you excited for the new Hunger Games? Where do you fall on the Hunger Games movies?
They're fine. I don't know. Like, I don't, I I'll probably see this when it comes to streaming. Like, I don't know that I'm
going to
a theater to check it out. But yeah, I don't know. What about you?
You're not here for like the nearly 3 hour reboot of the Hunger Games.
Is it really almost 3 hours?
I heard it's long. I heard it's very, very long. I don't know if IMDb has a runtime quite yet. I guess I could look as we speak. But yeah, let me.
I like Rachel
Zegler.
Two
hours and 45 minutes. 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Yeah,
that's too long.
Yeah, that's a lot.
I'm excited for it. I'm going to see it in theaters. Like, cool. I mean, Peter Dinklage looks great. I think it looks good. Genuinely, that's too long. I liked Hunger Games. I remember going to see them in theaters. Like when I was in high school, that was like the thing. Like the new Hunger Games came out, you went to go see it.
Jason Schwartzman, as I'm assuming he's playing Caesar Flickerman or whatever his name is. Like,
yeah, like
that
the host
looks like great casting. Like, I think it looks really good. I don't think it looks bad. I just don't have an interest in going to see it in the theaters. Like, yeah. I don't know. Let's just watch Battle Royale. You know what I mean?
That's fair. What I say. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I need to watch that for sure. Okay. Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi. She is Captain Phasma.
Yeah.
One
of the cooler, like, outfits. Super cool. The gear.
Yeah. 100%. Definitely one of the cooler, like, outfits in Star Wars. Last Jedi fan, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Good. I get nervous. I know that you like The Last Jedi, but it's still just anytime that those three words have to come out of my mouth, I just get nervous about what's about to go down.
Yeah.
You never know. Okay. Top of the Lake, which is a TV series. Obviously, In Fabric, which we just covered. Welcome to Marwin, the personal history of David Copperfield. Shout out Dave Patel Squad. The Hive Will Rise. Flux Gourmet, which was another film by Peter Strickland. Just wanted to call that out. The Sandman, Wednesday. And then I guess she is billed as being in the upcoming season of Severance.
Nice.
Pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, what are you going to pick?
I don't know how you pick anything but Game of Thrones. Like,
I know. I kind of left that off the list here. Yeah.
Yeah, Brienne of Tarth is just like one of the best characters out there. Gets one of the best character arcs, you know, as, you know, mixed feelings as people have about the end of that show. I think her character gets served correctly. So, I'm going to go with Game of Thrones.
I watched Game of Thrones all the way up until the Red Wedding. And then I was like, I got to take a mental break. That was intense. And then I never picked it back up because by the time I was ready to start was the big controversy of how it was ending. And I was like, listen, if I know this is going down the crapper, I'm not sinking on the ship. So
fair enough.
I just saved myself the time. I mean, like, I haven't seen some of these things. Like, I don't remember her character in Mockingjay Part 2, so I'm like, I'm not gonna pick that. I will pick The Last Jedi because I do like her as Captain Phasma. And I think her fight with Finn is pretty sick, to be honest with you. Like, I think that's pretty fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, that'd be my pick. Other A1 act, awkward/bad dates in movies.
Yeah.
Sheila goes on one terrible awkward date with Adonis and then goes on a okay date with who ends up kind of like hanging around and being the boyfriend. So I thought, what better way to kind of celebrate this and try to scrounge out some of the more awkward dates in movies? So In Fabric, Whiplash, really tough. For awkward first pizza date there for sure. Also wanted to shout out, there was maybe it is Whiplash I'm thinking of. I don't know. There was another movie I was trying to think of that has an awkward first date that I don't think I put on the list, but I guess we'll figure it out as we go. When Harry Met Sally, Pulp Fiction, Baby Mama, Knocked Up, Fargo, Annie Hall, Ed Wood, The Fisher King, American Psycho, There's Something About Mary, Back to the Future, Taxi Driver, which just recently on the rewatch, like, pretty awkward date in the diner there. Along Came Polly. Shout out Philip Seymour Hoffman for just being elite in that movie. Has nothing to do with the date, but he's great. After Hours, and then Zodiac. I wanted to put that on the list. We just covered that on the Patreon, or it's coming up on the Patreon in a few days when this episode comes out. The date at the lake where people end up dying and end up being killed looks like a very nice date, but technically a bad date. Goes wrong.
Yeah, it goes very wrong. Probably about as wrong as it can go, without a doubt. Yeah.
I don't know what I'm picking.
I think for mine, I'm picking one, but for like a different kind of reason, I'm going to go with There's Something About Mary. One that's not on here that I think would be interesting is that first scene of a movie we're going to talk about next week, Social Network.
Yes, that's a good one to put on here.
That first date is kind of very awkward. But I'm going to go with Something About Mary, but I'm going to go with it because while it wasn't a date, it was an awkward situation for me to go see that movie because I was taken and accompanied by my grandma to go see There's Something About Mary.
Sick.
And that is a very awkward movie to see with your grandma when you are a teenager. So, I mean, maybe at any age it's awkward, but definitely when you're a teenager. So that's the most awkward outing that I had.
Wow. Well, respect to you, Ben. Yeah. Very impressive. Cameron Diaz, I gotta be honest, like kind of anytime Cameron Diaz is supposed to be hot in a movie, it's like pretty awkward. She's good looking, but like still pretty awkward. There is a movie that I'm trying to think of, and I'll probably think of it once we finish recording or something, where these two people, they go on a date, and then the guy ends up like ordering a ton of food and then ends up having to like get it to go or something like that. I have a hunch that this is from the upcoming Jonathan Majors boxing film that I saw at Sundance last year. And for some reason, like that really, because he's trying to get out there and he's trying to date, and that like really stuck in my head as being really weird. Because like he's a boxer and he orders like a billion calories worth of food and ends up like smashing his face on the date. So that's worth calling out. I think I'm gonna go. Yeah, I mean Zodiac's pretty bad. Like that's a date gone bad for sure. That's a tough.
Back to the Future though, like. Going on a date with your mom, mom's trying to like get with you. Like that's real.
Yeah, that's a bad beat. Pulp Fiction's not necessarily a bad date, just more of like a little bit of an awkward date of like, hey, I don't think we can bone because then I might die and like I might be killed by my boss, which is never a good situation to be in. But I am gonna pick Whiplash, not necessarily for the first date, but I think if you can toss in the second date as well of like, we went on two dates and in the span of two dates, I started to like you. And then I told you exactly why, I can never be with you because you hold me back from everything I want to do in my life.
Yeah.
It's pretty shitty. That's pretty bad. Be on the receiving end of that is pretty bad.
That's a pretty bad date. Yeah, for sure.
pretty bad date for sure. Okay. A24 ranking for In Fabric.
I'm curious what yours is first. Because I feel like you enjoyed it more than I did, but I can't tell where it falls for.
Yeah, I definitely did. I'd be curious to know like what I rated Talk to Me. I know we're like infamously bad for keeping track of what we do. I'd be really curious to know where I put that because that's probably like the most recent new A24 horror movie that I've seen. I think I'm going to go with a B-24. But I think like Letterboxd style, I'm going to like heart it or I'm going to like favorite it just so I can like make a little nod and be like, it's a B-24. I think it's got some problems. I think it could use some more detail, some more very concrete ideas could, you know, benefit a little bit. But I like it. Like, I think there's just some kind of quality about it. It's really funny. It's really dark. It's horrific. It's very erotic. And I think it has certain qualities to it that I wouldn't mind revisiting it maybe like in a year and being like, oh yeah, that's a really good, like that's a pretty cool A24 horror movie. Like that's kind of fun to put on the long list. I think it's right there. So a B-24, but like a little bit of a heart.
I mean, it lines up exactly with what I was thinking. Cause I was gonna go with a C+24, it's above average. You know, it was a good time. Yeah,
throwback
old ranking system. Yeah, like it was a good time. So that's why I give it C+24.
I respect that. Yeah. Any closing thoughts on In Fabric?
No. Nope.
Have an open mic for anything. I said specifically about In Fabric. So don't.
I know.
Do what you're gonna do.
I won't do that. But if we get Peter Strickland on here, I would love to ask him some questions.
Yeah, definitely. Peter Strickland. If you know Peter Strickland or like if you can get this to him, let him know that we would love to sit down and talk with him about this movie. Because I think it is a really fascinating movie that's done well. And I have a lot of persistent questions that again, like begs me to want to watch it again because I'm like, maybe I just overlooked it. Like, maybe it's answered. Maybe there are details here and there, or whatever the case may be. Next week on the pod, another collaborative ranking is upon us. I know I mentioned at the top of the episode, the man, the myth, the cinematic legend, Martin Scorsese. We're getting someone from across the pond that's really big in the TikTok sphere of movies. Killers of the Flower Moon comes out the day that this podcast comes out, which is really exciting. That'll be thrown into the Scorsese mix. How the fuck are we going to rank the 11 best Scorsese movies?
It's going to be absurd. I've got my veto trigger ready for all the Irishman plays that are going to be out there.
Horseshit.
It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough, but I'm really excited about it.
I have a Scorsese ranking list that I'm like, that's live. That's like, as I go through, as I rewatch the movies, I'm updating and kind of figuring out where I lie for the draft. It is in private mode on Letterboxd. Nobody can see it but me. I think our guest Seth, Seth Film Reviews on TikTok and on Twitter and on Letterboxd as well, his list is public. And I know that'll be a very big point of contention on the draft is the energy that Seth is going to bring into this draft. I know you and I have our disagreements and the caverns are large, and I don't think we will agree. But Seth is going to bring in a whole different dynamic from a different planet, and I'm really interested to see where we're going to go.
That's the best part of these is the energy the third person brings in.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a whole new dynamic. Don't know what to expect. So this is, it's going to be rough.
It's going to be wild. I would not be surprised if it's like a 2-hour pod. I'm going to be quite honest with you.
Yeah. I'll have coffee for that one for sure.
Yeah, come prepped.
Yeah. what do you guys think about In Fabric? Have you seen this movie? Do you know, are the mannequins real people? Let us know. Obviously, we have no idea. You can hit us up. We're on Twitter and Instagram at 24 minutes of A24. Also, you can subscribe to us on YouTube where you can watch us talk about these movies. Mm-hmm. Ring the bell and whatever else that you do on YouTube to know when something drops. So we got all that going on. Plus, we have a Patreon going on, which is super fun. We talk about movies that aren't A24 movies. Right now, we're covering old Daddy Fincher himself, getting ready for The Killer. We have talked about The Game. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about Zodiac.
Wow.
We've got Social Network coming up. We got Gone Girl coming up. Like,
we are not covering Mank. Let me be very clear.
Yes, yeah, we are not covering Mank, so sorry to all the Mank heads out there.
Yeah.
But and then we're going to cover some more great directors throughout the rest of the year. So,
speaking of which, new Napoleon trailer just dropped this morning. Yeah. We're covering Ridley Scott in a couple of months.
Yeah,
and we're going to be talking about Napoleon on the pod, and we're doing it in 24 minutes, which is fucking unhinged.
And also, speaking of, we got a Ferrari trailer today, and
we're going to
be covering Michael Mann as well. So they're helping us out with our Patreon. So if you want to hear us talk about David Fincher, Michael Mann, and Ridley Scott, among other things, then you can support us on Patreon at 24 minutes of not A24. I get it confused. So look up the link. You'll find us on there, but you can support us there if you'd like. Either way, we are so grateful for everyone listening and supporting us. Thank you so much. I am Ben Lawhorn.
And I'm Ethan Simi. Spring break forever, bitches. I almost ended with, are the mannequins real?
Are the mannequins
I couldn't do
real?
it.